Civil War when they were sort of like looking at propaganda and different strategies to think about how they were bringing the American public back together. It's really a product of just American propaganda over time that most people have internalized that that's really the first story, but it really wiped away just the brutality, the genocide, the violence that the Pilgrims and colonization brought along with it. So let's all work together to rebrand Thanksgiving. Let's use it a day to not only come together, but to also recenter how we think about Native peoples today in this country, not as something in the past. An easy, fun activity for parents, for kids, for families to do is to just figure out whose Indigenous land are you on. You can go to native-land.ca. You literally type in your city, you know, where you're located, and it'll tell you whose land you're on. How many tribes are in your state today? What is going on in your local community? Are there Native organizations in your local community, in your state, tribes? What is going on with Native peoples today? There's Native films. There's so much stuff that people can just watch and like really see Native peoples in a contemporary context.
Stay with us now for Democracy Now!, a special presentation with Amy Goodman. KPFK, Los Angeles.
This is Democracy Now!, our holiday special.
The first Thanksgiving story is begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace.
Our history is the future. As the nation marks Thanksgiving, we speak to the Indigenous scholar and activist, Nick Estes, on settler colonialism and continuing Indigenous resistance. Then to the prize-winning author and journalist, Ta-Nehisi Coates, about his new book, The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank and Israel.
The occupied territories are segregated. The Jews segregated. It's not, you know, hard to understand. There are different signs for where different people can go. There are different license plates forbidding different people from going different places. Now, what the authorities will tell you is that this is a security measure. But if you go back to the history of Jim Crow in this country, they would tell you the exact same thing.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this special broadcast, we begin the show with the Indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes. He's co-founder of the Indigenous resistance group, The Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. His books include Our History is the Future, which tells the history of Indigenous resistance over two centuries, offering a roadmap for collective liberation and a guide to fighting life-threatening climate change. Estes centers this history in the historic fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. I asked him to talk about the two Thanksgiving stories he writes about at the beginning of his book.
The first Thanksgiving story is begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace. And then I begin with another story of a prayer march that we led in the Bismarck Mall in Bismarck, North Dakota, to kind of bring attention to the Standing Rock struggle during a Black Friday shopping event, which was met by police armed with AR-15s, who then began punching and kicking water protectors who were holding a prayer in the Bismarck Mall. And I thought it was a really kind of jarring sort of contrast between the past and the present, to say that while there are sort of differences between the massacre of Pequots in Massachusetts to the contemporary sort of fight against an oil pipeline, nonetheless, you know, Bismarck, North Dakota is a 90% white community, that originally the Dakota Access Pipeline was supposed to go upriver from, but then was rerouted downriver to disproportionately affect the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. And disproportionate is the language that the Army Corps of Engineers use, as if there's ever a proportionate risk to environmental issues and water contamination. So at this particular moment, there weren't any actions that were happening in the camps, and it was largely at a standstill. And I think at that Thanksgiving weekend, there was an un-Thanksgiving feast that was held in the camps, and it was actually the highest point of the camps themselves, in the sense that there were the most sort of water protectors had showed up. So I thought it was a good kind of contrast to show that this history, you know, is a continuing history of genocide, of settler colonialism, and basically the founding myths of this country.
Your book's last words are, "We're challenged not just to imagine, but to demand the emancipation of Earth from capital. For the Earth to live, capitalism must die." Explain.
So that line is part of, you know, this longer section on liberation. And I think when we think about climate change, oftentimes the question of climate change really centers on market-driven solutions, such as, you know, green capitalism, and how do we create markets that sort of incentivize transition to sustainable economies, right? And I think really what we're kind of like beating around the bushes is that it's the system of capitalism that led us into this economic crisis to begin with. It's the sort of designation of certain populations in certain territories as disposable that has led us into our current epoch of global climate change. And so when we talk about who's going to bear the most burden when we transition, you know, out of the carbon economy, it most likely is going to be those populations that have historically been colonized. You know, and you know what's happening in Southeast Africa is a perfect example of why we need to transition away from not just the carbon economy, but capitalist economies in general. Because if we look at the history of how Africa has been a resource colony for Europe and for North America, we can look internally in the United States and understand that indigenous nations continue to serve as resource colonies for the United States, whether it's the Navajo Nation, where I'm living right now, that is producing oil and coal to generate electricity for the Southwest region, or whether it's the Fort Berthold Reservation up in North Dakota, that is, you know, the ground zero for oil and gas development in the Bakken region. We have to understand that indigenous nations have largely been turned into resource colonies and sites of sacrifice for not just the United States, but for the oil and gas industry. And so we need to not just think beyond climate change and putting carbon into the atmosphere, but we actually need to think about the system, the social system, right, that created those conditions in the first place. And so capitalism is fundamentally a social relation. It's a profit-driven system, whereas indigenous sort of ways of relating is one about reciprocity and mutual sort of respect, not just with the human, but also with the non-human world. And we're undergoing, you know, the sixth massive extinction event, which is caused by not just climate change, but is caused by capitalist sort of systems and the profit-driven sort of motive of our current economic and social system.
Nick Estes, you focus on seven historical moments of resistance in your new book, Our History is the Future. You say they form a historical roadmap for collective liberation. How did you choose these histories? Just quickly take us through them.
Sure. So I begin at the camps. I begin in the present, you know, at Standing Rock, and then I go to the fur trade with the first U.S. invasion, which was Lewis and Clark, who trespassed through our territory and were stopped by our leadership. And then I go through the Indian Wars of the 19th century and the Buffalo Genocide, and then I go into talking about the damming of the Missouri River in the mid-20th century, and then looking at red power in the 1960s and the 1970s, and how all of these indigenous people who were relocated because their lands were flooded by these dams eventually found themselves and created sort of the modern indigenous movement known as Red Power, and then going back and ending actually at Standing Rock in 1974 with the creation of the International Indian Treaty Council, which really coalesced these generations of indigenous resistance and took the treaties, the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, to the world and to the United Nations. And to do that, they looked to Palestinians. They looked to the South African anti-apartheid movement, who provided the mechanisms for recognition of indigenous rights at the United Nations. And that all resulted over four decades in the Touchstone document, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was passed by the UN in 2007. And so in many ways, when we look at Standing Rock and we go down Flag Row and we see the hundreds of tribal nation flags that were represented in 2016 and 2017, we also saw the Palestinian flag that was there, kind of hearkening back to that international solidarity with movements of the global South, and specifically our Palestinian relatives who, you know, today are still facing, much like us, are still facing the brunt and the brutality of settler colonialism, whether it's the United States recognizing the annexation of the Golan Heights, or whether it's, you know, here in North America and the continued dispossession of indigenous territory and rights. We can see that settler colonialism in Israel or in Palestine is really an extension of settler colonialism in North America. And then I end, you know, with back at the camps and looking at how these camps really provided, you know, I actually look at a physical map that was handed out to water protectors who came to the camp. And on that map, there was, you know, where to find food, where to find the clinics, right? And where to find the security and all the camps that were represented at the at Standing Rock. And to me, that provided, you know, a kind of interesting parallel to the world that surrounded the camps, which was 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions. You had the North Dakota National Guard, the world of cops, the world of the militarized sort of police state. And in the camps themselves, you had sort of the primordial sort of beginnings of what a world premised on indigenous justice might look like. And in that world, you know, everyone got free food. There was a place for everyone, you know, the housing, you know, obviously was transient housing and teepees and things like that. But then also there was health clinics to provide health care, alternative forms of health care to everyone. And so if we look at that, it's housing, education, all for free, right? A strong sense of community. And for a short time, there was free education at the camps, right? Those are things that most poor communities in the United States don't have access to, and especially reservation communities. But given the opportunity to create a new world in that camp centered on indigenous justice and treaty rights, society organized itself according to need and not to profit. And so where there was, you know, the world of settlers, settler colonialism that surrounded us, there was the world of indigenous justice that existed for a brief moment in time. And in that world, instead of doing to settler society what they did to us, genociding, removing, excluding, there's a capaciousness to indigenous resistance movements that welcomes in non-indigenous peoples into our struggle, because that's our primary strength, is one of relationality, one of making kin, right?
Nick, explain your title, Our History is the Future.
So that has two meanings. The first meaning is sort of a negative meaning, in the sense that the Ocheti Shakoi, the Great Sioux Nation, has undergone several apocalypses, you know, going back to the fur trade and the annihilation of fur-bearing animals in our region, going back to the annihilation of the buffalo to take the land and to starve us into surrender. Going back to the mid-20th century damming of the Missouri River, and now the North American sort of oil boom, these are different rounds of dispossession that, you know, we see in a long continuum, right? And while history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, there's echoes that the United States has bailed itself out largely at the expense of indigenous peoples and indigenous lands. And so in many ways, you know, what we're trying to prevent is that history in the future. But the other more sort of positive and generative aspect of that is our history is the future in the sense that we have a long tradition of resistance to these sort of U.S.-imposed climate catastrophes on our own community. And we draw from, you know, the resistance movements going back to the first time we halted the trespass of Lewis and Clark through our territories and said, no, we are a sovereign nation. We have protection. We are the protectors of the Missouri River. Going back to the 19th century Indian Wars, and then, you know, my grandparents were water protectors in their own right because they fought for and tried to defend the Missouri River by preventing the construction of the Pixelone Dams in the 1950s and the 1960s. And so in many ways, I am just a product of my ancestors' resistance. They were water protectors before, and we have a new generation of water protectors now.
Nick Estes, indigenous scholar and activist, speaking in 2019. His books include Our History is the Future. He's co-founder of the indigenous resistance group, the Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. When we come back, we speak with the prize-winning author and journalist, Ta-Nehisi Coates. He has a new book out. It's called The Message, based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank and Israel.
Changing tide, river rise, the waters high. Let it flow by. The flood can wash away these roots that grow for you. Fear won't blind me from the truth I can see through. Submerged again, too deep to forsake what we began.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday special, we spend the rest of the hour with the acclaimed writer and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message, which is based in part on a trip he took last year to the occupied West Bank in Israel. Coates compares Israel's apartheid system to that of Jim Crow here in the United States. He writes, "It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet under American patronage that resembled the world that my parents were born into," unquote. In his book, Coates also writes about traveling to Senegal, where he visited the slave trade memorial at Gorée Island, and going to South Carolina, where school officials tried to ban his book, Between the World and Me, which won the National Book Award in 2015. His current book, The Message, is written as a letter to his students at Howard University, where Ta-Nehisi Coates is the Sterling Brown Endowed Chair in the English Department. The Message is Coates' first collection of nonfiction since his 2017 book, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to Ta-Nehisi Coates in October. I began by asking him about where the book begins, Senegal. I asked him to talk about a journey he took there with great trepidation.
As you said, you know, we'll spend a lot of time talking about the occupied territories in Israel and the West Bank, but it's good to start here because the two parts are kind of paired to each other. African Americans are a group of people who have lived under the weight of an artifice a creation, a kind of mythology of what Africa is in our minds. If all of the myths of racism, all the justifications for enslavement, all the justifications for Jim Crow, at the end of the day, they have their origins in these constructions of Africa as this savage place, the idea that, you know, having been brought here, we're better off. Very, very typical of, you know, colonizing and conquering a movement. And one of the things we've done to push back is create our own narratives, our own journeys, our own ideas of what Africa is. My very name comes out of that, which I'm very uncomfortable with, as I talk about in the book. And
talk about it.
Oh, boy. Oh, Lord. I wrote it. I should be very comfortable talking about it. You know, I was born in 1975. And that was a period in time coming out of Black Power, coming out of, you know, Black is Beautiful, like really discovering this idea that our sense of beauty, our nose, our lips, our names, our hair, that we had the right to take control over that, including our history. And so my name is an ancient Egyptian name that refers to the ancient kingdom of Nubia. The notion was that, put very, very crudely, that if the West had its kings and queens, if it had its great monuments, if it had its great ideas, so did we. And part of growing older, part of, you know, and I actually talk about this in Between the World and Me, part of becoming a writer, actually, is like our job is to be skeptical of clean stories. And I learned that very, very early on. And the message is kind of a continuation of that. Of course, the ultimate, I would say, I guess, climax in that journey is going to see the continent itself. And moving past myth, moving past the idea of constructed narratives, even when they're liberatory, even when they're emancipationists, to see the people themselves. And that is what took me to Dakar. And that is what I think took so long for me to go to Dakar.
And in terms of what most surprised you in the trip, could you talk about that?
Yeah, which most surprised me is the thing that will not surprise any African-American watching this interview. It was my deep sorrow. It was my deep, deep, deep sorrow. And I think, like, much of what I've, you know, just said in answer to Amy's question, I'd already intellectualized before I went. And so I was already thinking about this, but thinking about something and being confronted with it is a totally, totally different thing. It's a great Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they got punched. And as soon as that plane started descending out of the clouds over Dakar and I saw the buildings rising up, I was being punched. It is one thing to think about the Middle Passage, to think about your ancestors theoretically. It is quite another to literally sit on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean and look out and understand that this was, even if only symbolically, last stop.
And when you went to Gorée, you decided that you did not want to have any of the tour guides.
No.
You wanted to wander around mm-hmm. on your own.
No, but
talk about that experience.
By then, it was like day three. And so I understood that as much as I thought I was going to see the continent, I was actually going to see some sort of departed version of myself, you know, from hundreds of years ago. I was walking with ghosts the whole time, and I didn't want to be talked to. My family is from the eastern shore of Maryland, not too far from Ocean City, for anybody who knows that geography. It's like right on the Atlantic Ocean. And so to get back to Senegal, to get to Dakar, which is itself right on the tip of the continent, you know, I would look out and I would have these moments and I would say, my God, you know what I mean? There's part of me all the way on the other side and there's part of me that's here. And so, again, Gorée is a place that has a lot of story and a lot of myth around it. And I read about that. I thought I was fully prepared. But I'm going to tell you, brother, you get on that boat and that boat pulls off and you think about all of your ancestors. And it was 7 a.m. in the morning and I was alone on that boat. And it is a very, very different experience.
And back to your name, Ta-Nehisi,
yes.
And also which goes to your parents as well,
yes.
And how their influence on you. Your dad, a former Black Panther, ran mm-hmm. a publishing press right in your house.
Yeah. No, and I think like what they were really trying to do, and this actually goes to the core of what the book is about. How do you tell your own story? How do you free yourself from a history, from novels, from film, from television, an entire architecture that is designed to tell you that you are exactly where you belong because of who you are, because of what you are, either because of your genes, because God said, you know, you belong there. How do you construct something different? And one of the things I'm trying to confront in the book is, I think perhaps step one is almost to make a mirror image of the people that have put you in that situation. Well, you say with this, we're actually that. But I think one of the most difficult things is to free yourself entirely of that structure and to construct your own morality, your own stories, your own ideas that don't necessarily depend on those who have put you in the situation to begin with.
And the structure of your book is addressed to your students at Howard. The decision to choose that form for your book?
You know, I was, to be honest with you, I've not said this anywhere. I was very worried about that because I'd done that. Like, I'd written this letter in Between the World and Me, and I thought people could get, oh, my God, he's going to do this again, what, Between the World and Me again. But the fact of the matter is I am always trying to achieve intimacy with the reader. That's the, you know, the primary job. I would tell my students all the time, look, you are dealing with readers who could be doing anything else. They could be on their smartphones. They could be playing video games. They could be watching movies. They could be watching TV. They could be somewhere making love. They could be doing anything but reading you. And so you have a responsibility to make them feel a sense of intimacy and immediacy. And I was lucky in the sense that, you know, these were very, very real conversations that I'd had with my students, so I had something to pull from, you know. And also, you know, the fact of just the letter form allowed me to do that. It allows me to get, you know, a kind of intimacy with my reader.
Talk about George Orwell, Why I Write, and connecting politics and language in the promise you made to your students at Howard. Your Between the World and Me was written to your son, Samari, This to the students.
Yeah. So we usually start actually with politics in the English language. That's the first essay that I have them read, you know, just to think about language as a political thing. You know, we live in this world where I feel that oftentimes we are taught, not that everybody subscribes to this, that art lives over here and politics lives over here. And that politics itself is actually very, very limited, that, you know, it happens every 2 or 4 years. It's in the voting booth. It's who you decide, you know, to vote for. It's what issues you decide to activate on. But one of the arguments that I make in the message is that there's an entire architecture outside of the world of mean politics that determines how politicians actually talk, the choices they give, you know, et cetera. Why does Kamala Harris feel the need, for instance, to say that she has a gun? What is that actually based on? And I would say it is based on archetypes of femininity. I would say it's built based on archetypes of race, archetypes of the cowboy. And where do those archetypes come from? They come from our art. They come from our literature. They come from our film, our TVs, our commercials. You know, and at their base, they ultimately come from writing because somebody has to write those ultimately. And in that world, things that seem separated from politics never really are. And so I wanted to start this book, The Message, with that Orwell quote, because that's like one of the things he kind of is obsessing with in that essay. And at the same time, there's this beautiful tension that I often feel, which is in a different world. You know, he would just write beautiful stories. He would just play with language for the hell of playing with language. But he doesn't live in that world. And I don't feel that my students live in that world. They live in a world of, as we'll talk about, genocide, apartheid, segregation, global warming, you know, Category 5 hurricanes, you know, flood on one coast, fire on the other. These are immediate issues. And I don't believe that they as writers, we as writers, have the luxury of sort of sitting back in our salons and in our living rooms, you know, simply constructing beautiful language for the hell of constructing beautiful language. It has to be engaged with something. Ta-Nehisi,
from Senegal, you take us to Columbia, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Why that choice?
Well, I was writing this in a time where this wave of book bannings was happening. And I always wanted to write about that. But I felt that I was worried about making the writer the center of the book banning. Because even though the work is directed at the writer, the writer is actually not the person that suffers under the book ban. The teachers suffer under the book ban. It's the teachers who are under threat for losing their job. It's the teachers who get harassed. It's the librarians who are under threat of losing their jobs. It's the librarians who get harassed. It's the students who lose the ability to have access to different worlds and different ways of thinking. And I was trying to figure out how I could write this in such a way so that I would not be the center of it. Luckily, you know, I ended up in conversation with a teacher by the name of Mary Wood from Chapin, South Carolina, went to Chapin High School where she teaches and where she was trying to teach Between the World and Me and got into some amount of trouble for that. And she invited me down, you know, just to, you know, go to a hearing. And that's what I did. And it was quite eventful. It was not the world that I expected. It was not the the audience I expected. It was interesting to see how much support actually was rallied behind her, even though she's in a deep red area, in a deep red state. And so that, too, is about the power of stories. That, too, is about the power of narratives, the questions we ask and the questions we don't.
You write in the message about this experience in South Carolina. I see politicians in Colorado and Tennessee and South Carolina moving against my own work, tossing books I've authored out of libraries, banning them from classes. I feel snatched out of the present and dropped into an age of pitchforks and book-burning bonfires. My first instinct is to laugh, but then I remember that American history is filled with men and women who were as lethal as they were ridiculous.
Right.
Now, if
you got one running for president right now, you know, lethal and ridiculous.
Well, you talk about the area you were in, 70-30 split, 70% for Trump. And yet, and this is what you were just talking about, this 30%, how surprised you were by the minority, the power of it when it's mobilized.
Yeah, you know, it's like one of these things, like, again, like this goes back to how we construct language. It's either a blue or red district, right? Even purple doesn't quite, like, carry the quite, you know, like, the real context. So you think it's red, okay, battle's over, why am I here? You know? But 30%, and 30% activated around an actual issue is actually a lot of people. You know what I mean? And it was like, I could not have known that without seeing it. Like, you have to, and this is, like, one of the messages I have, you know, for my students in the book. You have to walk the land. You can't, you know, sit on your butt reading reports, you know what I mean? And even reading books like this one and say, hey, I'm going to be a writer. You have to have actual experiences. So I have to walk in that room, you know, and meet this, you know, white woman in her 70s, you know, who tells me in the wake of George Floyd, we organized a reading group at our church for black authors. And I love Colson Whitehead. Oh, my God. Have you read him? You know, like I have to have that experience with somebody. You know, I have to have that shock, you know. And so I just feel like it was like really, really important in the message to actually model the work that I was articulating or model the lessons that I was actually articulating for my students.
When you just referred to President Trump, can you elaborate further?
He looks ridiculous, but he is, in fact, quite lethal, you know. And I think certainly in 2016, there was great, great temptation to laugh. You know what I mean? You hear these things, you know, you hear him say certain things, you know, you see him, you know, in certain places, and there's a kind of dismissiveness. But what we actually are dismissing is a kind of darkness that I think lurks deep, deep within all of us and can actually be appealed to. It's not comfortable to say that you can win through hate. It's not comfortable to say that you can win through anger. It's not comfortable to say historically it actually has been very effective at, you know, electorally to pick out weak people or people who are not in, you know, the most advantaged political space and to demonize them and use them as a tool, that actually has been quite effective for people in pursuit of power. We would rather think that good wins all the time, that people see the best in each other. It reifies our notions of what America is, our stories that we tell ourselves of what America is. But it doesn't correspond with the actual history and the truth.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message. In a minute, we'll return to our conversation and talk about Israel and Palestine.
Tell the world that I was searching for a love I've never known. Yeah.
stop my crying. When you touch me with your smile.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing this holiday special with Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed him on October 8th, one day after hundreds of activists rallied in Union Square in New York for a Jewish-led vigil on the first anniversary of October 7th to mourn Israelis and Palestinians who've been killed, and to call for an end to the Israeli massacre in Gaza. After the vigil, I spoke to Ava Borgwart, a spokesperson for the group, If Not Now. Right now, people are wearing signs that say, no U.S. money for bombs. And talk about the motto of this October 7th vigil.
So the motto is Every Life, a Universe, and it's from Pikuach Nefesh, which says that to destroy a life is to destroy an entire world, and to save a life is to save an entire world. And our government is not treating every single life as a universe. They're treating Palestinian lives as less sacred.
How did you get so involved with this issue?
I got involved through the Ferguson uprising, and I was watching Black and Palestinian activists trading tips on Twitter about how to deal with tear gas, and it became clear that Palestinians in the West Bank are facing a military charged with policing, and Black Americans are facing a militarized police force. And that was my entry point, where I said I need to organize my community, which was unable to, which was limited in being able to show up for the civil rights fight of our time, for the Black Lives Matter movement, because they were upset about the messaging for a free Palestine in those protests. And so I've spent the last 10 years of my life working on building the movement of Jewish Americans who are calling for equality, justice, and a thriving future for all, no matter where people live.
That's Ava Borgwart of the group If Not Now, one of hundreds of people here in New York City in Union Square for two large rallies on the anniversary of October 7th. Our guest today is Ta-Nehisi Coates, the prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, The Message, in part about a visit he took last year, organized by the Palestine Festival of Literature, PALFEST, to the West Bank and Israel. Talk about this whole journey you took. You were part of the PALFEST, and then you also stayed.
Yeah, and I guess, to be honest, my journey began 10 years ago when I published the case for reparations. And there was a section, again, as a writer, as a journalist, you're always trying to make people feel things, make things real. And there was a section where I offered an analog for reparations, for how it could possibly look. And it was from West Germany to the state of Israel. And I need to be very specific about that, not to Holocaust survivors, but to the state of Israel itself. And that part of that essay came under quite a bit of critique. And what became clear to me was deservedly so. It took 10 years for me to get it fixed because writing takes a long time, you know. But I knew I had to, like, that I was going to have to go at some point. You know, I knew it wouldn't be enough for me to, you know, appear at a rally, do a slogan, whatever. And long story short, I began talking to PALFEST in 2016, finally got there in 2023, just in time for The Message. I spent 5 days with them. Mostly traveling through the occupied territories and through East Jerusalem as a Palestinian would, getting a sense of what their daily life was. And then the next 5 days, I spent mostly in the company of a group called Breaking the Silence, former IDF veterans who are against the occupation. And I saw the country largely through the views of an Israeli, how they move through the world, how they move through Jerusalem, how they move through the roads. But I also, again, you know, spent a lot of time actually talking, you know, more to Palestinians. It was revelatory. I don't think the average American has a real sense of what we're doing over there. And I emphasize what we're doing, because it's not possible without American support. I have heard people say over and over again that there are great evils happening in the world.
states across the world perpetrating evils against whole groups of people. Why pick on Israel? And the thing I say is, I'm an American. This is the thing that we have our fingerprints on. Those bombs over Gaza, the planes that drop bombs on Gaza, the plaques that I saw, for instance, in Jerusalem. All of that is America. And we are going around the world propping ourselves up as the font of democracy. We are going around the world propping Israel up as the only democracy in Middle East. This is a deep, deep fiction, a very, very dangerous fiction that must be addressed. And that's what I tried to do in the book.
You write in the book, quote, "It occurred to me that there was still one place on the planet under American patronage that resembled the world that my parents were born into." Can you elaborate?
Yes. And I think I talked about it the last time I was here, actually. These are the words I have even now, and they are probably insufficient to what a Palestinian would offer who experiences this. But the words that come to me are segregation. When you are on the West Bank, there are separate roads. There are roads for Israeli settlers and citizens of Israel, and there are roads for Palestinians. These roads are not separate and equal. These roads tend to be separate and unequal. It tends to take longer to get where you want to go if you're a Palestinian. If you enter a city like Hebron, for instance, Hebron is quite literally segregated. There are streets that Palestinians cannot walk down. There are streets that, you know, Israeli settlers are giving complete and free movement of. Moving throughout the West Bank in general, there are checkpoints everywhere for Palestinians. These checkpoints are sometimes normal checkpoints that they know are there. Sometimes checkpoints appear out of the blue, what they call flying checkpoints. Your basic movement is constantly imperiled. The justice system, which is deeply familiar for African Americans here, is quite literally segregated. There is a civil justice system that the minority of Israeli settlers as Israeli citizens enjoy. And then there is an entirely separate justice system that our Palestinians on the West Bank are subject to. You can be arrested, for instance, as an Israeli citizen, and you are, you know, do all the due rights that we are familiar with. You have to be told what the charges are, etc. If you are arrested as a Palestinian, you can just be taken. In another political context, we would call those hostages, because nobody has to say why you're taken. Nobody has to say what you were taken for. Nobody has to inform your family. You are under the jurisdiction of the military. It has been this way since 1967. And the word we use for that is occupation, which is a kind of deeply vanilla word that does not actually describe what is going on. How a country that maintains this separate and unequal system, how a country that does not even allow the quote-unquote Palestinian citizens of the state full equality with its Jewish-Israeli citizens is allowed to refer to itself as a democracy is a mystery to me, and the closest analog I can think of is the time in which the United States of America referred to itself as a democracy, even as it was disenfranchising whole swaths of black people in the southern states. And so when I say Jim Crow, when I say segregation, that is because that is the period that immediately comes to mind for me.
Talk about being stopped by an Israeli soldier, Ta-Nehisi.
Oh, well, we were stopped all the time, to be clear, you know, because we were on the roads. We were constantly stopped. You know, I was, you know, you just kind of got used to it after a while, which was also weirdly familiar. But I think the instance you're referring to is when I was in Hebron, which is a flashpoint for anybody that's been over there. I was walking down the street attempting to patronize a Palestinian vendor, and IDF soldier stopped out. He was young enough to be my son, stopped out and asked me what was my religion. It was clear that I had to state my religion in order to pass. When I told him that I was not religious, he asked what my mother's religion was. When I told him my mother wasn't particularly religious, he asked what my grandmother's religion was. And this is a very, very important thing, because when you start asking what my mother and grandmother's religion is, you are referring to something beyond, do I accept Christ as my, you know, personal savior, or what God I pray to. You are asking a deeper question about my ancestry. And it became clear that if I did not give the right answer to that question, I would not be allowed to pass. I highlight this because when you hear Palestinian and Palestinian American activists make the charge of racism, this is what they're talking about. Why does who my grandmother or my mother worship matter if we're strictly talking about a God? Not that it would be right, even in that sense. But when you hear the charge of racism, this is what people are referring to.
Ta-Nehisi, this is a powerful book, and you went on CBS This Morning recently to talk about the publication of it. And I want to go to that interview on CBS This Morning. The New York Times is now reporting CBS News has rebuked one of the morning anchors, Tony DeCoppel, over what he did in that interview to you. And maybe you could also say to his fellow anchors as he dominated this. CBS executives said the interview fell short of the network's editorial standards. This is an excerpt of that interview.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. And I have to say, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist. And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it? Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel in any condition has a right to exist?
Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media. That's the first thing I would say. I am most concerned always with those who don't have a voice, with those who don't have the ability to talk. I have asked repeatedly in my interviews whether there is a single network, mainstream organization in America with a Palestinian American bureau chief or correspondent who actually has a voice to articulate their part of the world. I've been a reporter for 20 years. The reporters of those who believe more sympathetically about Israel and its right to exist don't have a problem getting their voice out. But what I saw in Palestine, what I saw on the West Bank, what I saw in Haifa in Israel, what I saw in the South Hebron Hills, those were the stories that I have not heard.
So, Ta-Nehisi, you sitting on the set of CBS This Morning with the former football player, now anchor, Nate Burleson, Gayle King, very well known, both African-American anchors, and Tony DeCoppel. He dominated the discussion, talking about your book could be found in an extremist backpack. Talk about the backlash on this, the aftermath of this, and also who you felt was most wronged in this.
Well, it wasn't me. I mean, at that part, let me talk. It was not me, you know. It certainly, and I don't know if there was anybody on that set. Look, I think there is a meta conversation that happens here where we end up, because we're media, where we end up talking about media and media politics. But I do think it's really important to broaden the frame from the few people that were there and talk about what was actually excluded and who was actually excluded from that conversation by the very structure itself. I just don't want to lose sight of that. I don't really have a problem with a tough interview. You know, I knew what I wrote. You know, I knew I'd be confronted. Was he rude? Was he aggressive? I can't really get into that. Like, it's not really something that I think too much about. The question I would ask, though, is how often on CBS, on NBC, on ABC, or any major news organization, do you see someone who is a defender of the Israeli state project get confronted in that kind of way? Given a tough interview in that kind of way? When was the last time you saw, for instance, a defender of Israel, a defender of Zionism, confronted with the fact that major human rights organizations say that Israel is practicing apartheid? How do you defend that? When is the last time you've seen an interviewer? How often do you see interviewers? Because I don't want to say it never happens. How often do you see interviewers say, listen, we have, you know, the former head of Human Rights Watch that says you are practicing genocide right now in Gaza. How do you respond to that? How often do you say that? How often do you see, how do you define yourself as a democracy when fully half the people under your rule are not equal? There is no problem with confronting me. You know, I would like to see some other people confronted. And the second part of that is who gets to do the confronting in the first place. I have said, and I will continue to say, I am a little uncomfortable with this role and a little uncomfortable with the publicity, not because I feel like I do not know, but because I feel like there are people who are going through this experience and who have gone through this experience who know so much more, who are completely out of the frame. And those are Palestinians and Palestinian Americans. So it's not just the issues that I raise and the confrontation. The question I would ask is, you have to imagine a world where a Palestinian American journalist could be on a mainstream show like CBS This Morning and confront someone who wrote a book that, say, defended Israel or defended Zionism with that kind of aggression. It's fine if I get it, but I want to live in that world, too. You know, and that really is, you know, like one of the things I was really, really trying to get at in the book, in the message. You know, it's the questions we ask. It's the stories we get to tell and the stories that we don't tell. And perhaps most importantly, it's who gets to tell them and who doesn't. And I really feel this passionately. This is not about me. This is not about Tony. This is not about Gail. This is not about Nick. We're going to be fine. It's the people who are invisible. It's the people who were not in that set, you know, on that set to begin with, who are not part of that conversation.
And Ta-Nehisi, this criticism that you weren't sufficiently taking into account the history, when the reality is, here we are on the anniversary of the October 7th attacks, and very little discussion occurs about what was Gaza like before October 7th of last year, and how were the residents of Gaza being treated, and essentially in an open air prison.
Yes, no, I completely agree. Look, I love that the young lady who was saying earlier in the lead-in, every life is a unified. I truly, truly believe that. And so, you know, as I've said before, like, there really is no part of my politics that has the ability to look at October 7th and not mourn the death, the massacre, the atrocities, you know, perpetrated. I just wish that some of my countrymen, especially Americans who are responsible for this, who are propping this up, had that same sort of compassion and that same sort of energy for October 6th, October 5th, etc. You know, this kind of abstracting events outside, you know, of their historical context is really necessary to the political order, because it allows us to justify ourselves and not have to think harder and not have to ask, you know, much deeper questions. You really have to be able to hold both, you know, and I know that sounds a bit cliche, but I truly do believe that you have to, you know, believe in this idea that I actually just heard today, that every life is a universe. I think that's a really, really beautiful articulation, you know, and that has to be true for all life. That has to be true on October 7th, you know, and loudly said, but it has to be true on 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 also.
And also, I wanted to go back for a second, because we are running out of time, and ask you about
my answers are so long.
about President Trump and the coming upcoming election. The great surprise to me of these years now is the enormous support that Donald Trump still has among huge swaths of the American public. To what do you attribute this?
Darkness. There's a darkness in all of us. I mean, this is not new, you know? I mean, and if you just took American history from the perspective of an African American, and I suspect the from the perspective of the indigenous people of this continent, what they would tell you is there is nothing new in people using power and people using the worst tropes in the world to win and to dominate. For any black person that, you know, grew up in the South from, I don't know, 1876 to 1964 and probably beyond, I'm being very conservative by saying that, this is what politics was. Like, this is just what we, you know, grew up under. And so I think maybe we thought, or we allowed ourselves to believe, that somehow, you know, we had escaped the gravity of history. But no people. No country escapes the gravity of history. We live within it. We are part of it. And so, you know, I think it's a very, very dangerous thing that our leaders led us to believe in 2016 that this was like a thing that could not happen in America. You know, whereas had we looked at history from another perspective, we would know that this actually is very American. You know, that doesn't make us, you know, inhuman or somehow demonically evil. And, you know, on the contrary, it just makes us human. It means that we're subject to, you know, the darkness in our souls like any other group of people would be.
Ta-Nehisi, I wanted to go to that point you say of who gets heard. We were at the Democratic convention. Everywhere we were interviewing people,
we saw you
in the background.
Yes, we were interviewing
the delegate from Michigan, from Florida, and from Connecticut, who unfurled a banner in the Florida delegation that said, "Stop arming Israel."
Yeah.
You were there as we were interviewing them in the hallway. When we were outside, when they were about to begin the sleep-in overnight demand that Kamala Harris allow a Palestinian-American to speak, you were there. And then the next day, and you wrote a piece in Vanity Fair about your experience, a Palestinian-American's place under the Democrats' big tent, the piece looking at the uncommitted movement and their unsuccessful efforts to have such a speaker. This is Rura Roman of the uncommitted movement. She's a Palestinian-American Georgia state representative. This is part of what she would have said if she was chosen.
For 320 days, we've stood together demanding to enforce our laws on friend and foe alike to reach a ceasefire and the killing of Palestinians, free all the Israeli and Palestinian hostages, and to begin the difficult work of building a path to collective peace and safety. That's why we are here, members of this Democratic Party committed to equal rights and dignity for all. What we do here echoes around the world. They'll say this is how it's always been, that nothing can change. But remember, Fannie Lou Hamer shunned for her courage, yet she paved the way for an integrated Democratic Party. Her legacy lives on, and it's her example we follow.
So that's Georgia State Representative Rua Roman. And needless to say, there was not a Palestinian-American voice on the stage. Last night, Kamala Harris did an interview with 60 Minutes. At least they played it last night. This is what she had to say about Israel-Palestine.
When we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is, without any question, our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks. Now, the work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop in terms of putting that pressure on Israel and in the region, including Arab leaders.
That's Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris speaking on 60 Minutes last night. As we wrap up, you were just talking about Trump. Talk about what the position of the Biden-Harris administration is right now. They did hold two separate commemorations yesterday. President Biden was at the White House, and he lit a candle and also, I think, crossed himself right after. And Kamala Harris, the vice president in the Naval Observatory, planted a tree, a pomegranate tree.
Well, and, you know, that's good and appropriate. You know, like I said, you know, we don't want to have a politic that does not take life serious and does not take loss of life serious. On the larger question, and maybe even as an extension of that, but we have to take all life seriously. I don't think we're doing that. This is morally untenable. What I saw was, and this is the first time I've ever said this or put this in this frame, and maybe, you know, the uncommitted delegates understood this. There was as much a moral gap between what I saw in Chicago, that is to say, to go on stage and promote these values of diversity, humanity, big tent, and to exclude the peoples whose families are being bombed right now, as it was in the early 1960s and, you know, before, when the Democratic Party, you know, claimed to be for the working man and the working person, while millions of workers all through the South were effectively in a system of indentured servitude, and they refused to give those people political representation. It is a gigantic moral gulf that is troubling, disappointing, heartbreaking, and deeply, deeply personally upsetting.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the new book, The Message. That interview was October 8th, 1 month before the presidential election. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Belkadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagara, Hugh Grant.
Donate your used car, truck, or boat to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program.